Hello and welcome to the show. My name is James Trupany. This is Telling Stories. Today we're back to the Rough Guide to Violence, Part 3, Know Your Gimmick Matches. This was posted on the 8th of September 2014, nearly 5 years ago for WrestleTalk.tv. And it looks at, well, pretty much everything to do with gimmick matches. How they're put together, why they exist, and where they come from. The Rough Guide to Violence, Part 3, Know Your Gimmick Matches. In previous entries in this series, we looked at the men who popularised the hardcore approach in their every appearance. It was something that made them stand out from the crowd, that willingness to go one step further all the time. Before men like Curry, the Sheik and Abdullah the Butcher, the idea of an ultra-violent moment was not something promoters were afraid of. It was just common logic to keep them few and far between. As promoters began to streamline wrestling into a TV-reliant and serving product, changing it to suit the medium, it occurred to them they could also change the rules to accommodate the end of a feud. Each territory thus began to develop specialties based on geographic history, local custom, and the personal stories that were being played out in the squared circle. This article looks at the specialists and the specialisms that accrued over the decades of territory development. The earliest gimmick matches are still used today. The lumberjack match that Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose competed in at SummerSlam had its roots in the heavy logging areas of the west coast of North America from Vancouver down to North Carolina, where obviously there was historically a lot of lumberjacks around. Similarly, the coal miner's glove match began its career, and the inspiration for what seems like Vince Russo's entire career, in the mining communities of the industrial northeast, where coal was plentiful, like in Pennsylvania. The whole idea was, and really should still be today, there had to be a reason for going there. Two heated rivals with either a very personal story to tell, or one man trying to get his match to be seen as an advantage. The psychological possibilities were a strong part of the attraction. Just as a battle royal could highlight a monster on your roster, a bull rope match could highlight another's unique talents, low centre of gravity for instance, and hide the shortcomings of an attractive draw, the guy with a low centre of gravity probably couldn't move that well, so this type of match would highlight his mobility. Essentially, they became part of the booking fabric of the wrestling world. The most famous of the feud settling endgames would be the steel cage match. It first appeared in 1937 in Atlanta, Georgia, possibly dreamt up on Bad Street, and the basic principle being to keep active participants inside while keeping all possible interference outside. While the aims are still the same, the composition of the cage has changed. Back then, the simple chicken wire was the resistant material. Now you're more likely to see a chain link fence. Even the WWE seemed to have retired Big Blue, that used to adorn the heated house show feud finishes of the 1980s. It looked like a big playpen for adults, and was about as intimidating. The added bonus of a steel cage match was the very increased likelihood of blood. It didn't take long for this skin-shredding attraction to take hold with promoters appearing in Canada in 1942 and then throughout the Great White North. So popular, in fact, it became the go-to tool of choice to settle disputes. There has always been an underlying current of dissent between wrestling fans as to what constitutes a good cage match, and part of that is in the layout of the rules. In the WWF, the point was to always escape the cage, which for me has the issue of plausibility. Here is your big babyface that you want to portray as heroic and noble, who has to win by running away. Generally, the territory is stuck with a basic formula, enabling the combatants to go at it uninterrupted, thus encouraging the likelihood of them being a bloody mess at the end. The cage was kept away from the serious wrestling content of the show. It was an attraction enough on its own. Some of the most famous cage matches occurred as non-title main events. Larry Zbysko versus Bruno Sammartino, for instance. Ric Flair and Greg Valentine wrestled the Andersons for the Mid-Atlantic tag titles in Charlotte, South Carolina in 1977, but they were kept away from the world title picture in the NWA. It was the WWWF's fascination with the cage. It was the WWWF's fascination with the cage that gave it title match credibility. Bruno Sammartino wrestled in the cage at Madison Square Garden quite regularly, defending the title against Captain Lou Albano and famously against Stan Hansen. The Hansen match was a perfect example of how to build a cage in that era and take advantage of what could be a bad situation. In a prior match, Stan had botched a body slam and dropping Bruno on his head and severely damaging his neck. In today's environment, anyone who had been that careless with a main event star would be bolt-holed down in NXT until their contract ran out, but back then, it was an opportunity. Hansen was billed literally as the man who had broken Sammartino's neck, apocryphally attributed to his lariat clothesline, the seemingly invincible Italian's most, up till now, dangerous foe. Screaming for revenge, Sammartino did his part of the injured party, and the bout was set in the steel cage at Madison Square Garden. The match itself wasn't great, but typical of the WWF main event of that era. It had a spectacle going for it. the injured and desperate Sammartino reaching down deep for the extra level of viciousness to defeat the biggest monster put in front of him so far. The popularity would have undoubtedly influenced Jim Crockett Promotions' decision-making process when heading into the build-up for the very first Starrcade in 1983. Having secured more or less control of the NWA, they had their chosen champion in Ric Flair. A one-time holder already, they needed something special to really push him over the edge as a worldwide draw, and that was capable of filling houses in every market. He also needed to replace Harley Race, the most successful of all the post-Luthes champions, and to top all that, he had to head the charge into the pay-per-view era. Though this event would be held on its precursor, closed-circuit TV, it wouldn't be long before technology caught up with the wrestling promotion's ambitions. As always, though this was a title match, there had to be a reason for the cage. With Race off on his travels as NWA champion, it would be hard to set a focus for Flair's ambition. Instead, proxies would keep Flair busy throughout his run-up to the event, making even more wrestlers in the process. Race was portrayed as clearly worried about Flair. A former champion, it was Flair he saw as the threat to his long-term dominance in the NWA. He set a bounty on Flair's head, which was cashed in on by Dick Slater and Cowboy Bob Orton Jr., Randy's father. It took incredible patience to build this match-up, with Race appearing only occasionally, and Flair, while strongly considering retirement, in a storyline sense, actually, it gave the whole card breathing room. Roddy Piper and Greg Valentine had the opportunity to talk up their dog collar chain match. Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood, in the thick of their series of the Briscoe Brothers, suddenly became more prominent, and then the icing on the cake was Race and Flair, for the world's title for the very first time in a steel cage. The bounty storyline also gave another reason for the cage. If Race could buy off Slater and Orton, who else would he bring in for help? The match did not disappoint. The young stud of a challenger truly taking his Flair for the gold to a career-making performance. It made his career, and it gave JCP a fascination with chain-link fencing that would manifest itself in their most famous match. As Dusty Rhodes grew to power in JCP, and therefore the NWA, he started to develop a product that he had worked on in his many travels around the world. Realizing that violent and often bloody blow-off was the key to making a feud work at the box office, he set about remaking JCP in that image. His own feuds were often built towards gimmick bouts. Of his personal specialities, the bull rope match was a firm favorite. His long feud with WWF champion Billy Graham thrilled the Madison Square Garden crowd. At the time, Vince McMahon commented that he'd never seen anything like that audience respond to those matches, one of which was a bull rope match that drew yet another sellout to the Garden, noticeably after Graham had lost the belt. Dusty had a very successful cage match with Ric Flair in their heated rivalry. He was also one of the first wrestlers and creative minds to truly popularise the use of barbed wire in his feud with Tully Blanchard over the NWA TV title. At the Great American Bash in 86, they had a barbed wire wrapped loosely around the ropes match, over $100,000 in cash that was suspended above the ring with a ladder posed at ringside ready for it to be retrieved. Barbed wire matches had all been around serving a similar status as the cage match, nowhere to run and nowhere to hide, and no one can help but with even the higher danger quotient of the barbs. Adding the ladder element increased the danger, and the very large Greensboro crowd were sent home happy when Dusty retrieved the bag. It was part of a wider story, Dusty versus the Horsemen. The Horsemen were put together in an attempt to steal houses, as Tully Blanchard put it, forming a team of mega heels together to draw in bigger venues on the Southern Atlantic seaboard. So it would go that if you could put a team of heels together, a team of faces would be even bigger money. Put those two entities in the same match, with intertwined issues causing friction, and you could possibly bust the bank. However, you need an environment that would make the most of that booking. Dusty Rhodes has been accused of many things, but he has a cinematic mind and thinks in large aesthetic sequences. It can be terrible, the Shockmaster for instance. However, whilst watching Mad Max Beyond the Terrordome, he was taken with the idea of reinventing the cage match. By placing two rings together and enclosing the wrestlers in with a roof, there truly would be no escape. By having entrants enter one at a time rather than as a team, you could build tension and build in a come-from-behind storyline should the face team lose the toss. And finally, it would be a submission-only decision, thus creating a definitive winner and loser, making the efforts of all involved seem noble. It was in fact a genius booking idea, and it would become War Games, the match beyond. And while the Horsemen were hot, and Dusty Rhodes and the Road Warriors and a rotating array of other faces were hot too, it became the go-to attraction for the NWA. It debuted as part of the Great American Bash Tour, as a special live event-only attraction. Keeping it to house shows meant big gates, and in keeping with the exclusive appeal, the wrestlers involved hyped it in such a manner. When asked what it would take to make him quit in a War Games match, Road Warrior Hawk replied, "I'd rather die first." While the violence and enclosed feel of the War Games did have its appeal, it must be noted it was usually the 10 biggest stars in the company who were performing together, increasing the quality and star appeal of the matches in question. When it came down to a rather lackluster NWA vs. Horseman match in the late 90s, there was much less call for it. The competitors, though often stellar in their day, Ric Flair and Kurt Hennig, for example, were not up to their full powers of persuasion. And of course, it had to be sanitized within an inch of its life, not so much as the match beyond, but as the match you'd forgotten we put on. It became part of the establishment, and when that happened, it ceased to be a creative crucible. Pro wrestling is built on exceptions. When you make something that goes beyond exception, and use it often enough, it stops being special and just is. The War Games match is, of course, hugely influential, it being the basic principle for the Lethal Lockdown, which sadly only ever uses one ring, which is a drawback in this high-spot-laden world. It's also the basic principle behind the Elimination Chamber, which aids the space required by its pod platform extensions. However, outside of the indie shows, and MLW did try to develop the concept, or borrow the match format in the early 2000s, the style of worker and the storytelling needed simply doesn't exist today. Of course, some matches are special because they can't be done too often, and with good reason. The Scaffold match being a prime example. Though not violent in the blood and gut sense, anyone with a basic understanding of height can see they will be awfully traumatic to the human body. The principle is simple. Have a scaffold above the ring, the loser is the first person thrown off. Elementary in concept, usually dire in execution, but even this match had its specialists. The Midnight Express's Bobby Eaton is widely lauded as the king of the scaffold by no lesser authority than Mick Foley, who has flung himself off many things, including a scaffold many times. One of the early scaffold matches appeared in Memphis in 1971 when Jerry Jarrett defeated Don Green. But as its popularity grew throughout the South, it would be the perfect Southern tag team of the Midnight Express, often with Jim Cornette hanging on for dear life behind them, who would make it their own. Taking on the Rock and Roll Express in the Mid-South in 1984, before moving to JCP, and having matches with the Road Warriors under the same circumstances. A concept so beloved by JCP, they named the Starcade that year Night of the Skywalkers, that being the one where, infamously, Jim Cornette did an awful lot of damage to his knee, which curtailed any thoughts he might have had about having a wrestling career. A rematch with the Rock and Roll in 1987 at Starcade, and bizarrely one more time in 2005 for CCW, when all the participants should have known better, these matches were, and still are, incredibly stupidly dangerous. Foley's first major fall of his career would also occur in a scaffold match against Eric Embry in Texas. His headfirst dive towards Ground Zero as he mistimed his swing showed the inherent dangers. There's also the point that barely anyone in the arena could see anything, as it was that far up only folks sensible enough to buy cheap seats had a view. It was a kind of wrestling socialism, I guess. The scaffold match has its limitations. Specifically, anyone who has heft is not going to be of any use. Some of the most spectacular recent scaffold matches, and when I say recently, I mean within the last 20 years, because thankfully people have realised how dumb they are, have been aided by four breaking tables. Tommy Dreamer versus Primetime Brian Lee in ECW on a platform built by the Sandman himself, and New Jack versus Vic Grimes in XPW. Each had ludicrous falls that were salvaged partly by the table support. The infamous match between New Jack and Grimes was, of course, even more dangerous because of New Jack's complete lack of respect for Grimes' well-being, so just as well, they lost popularity. The amount of regional and situation-specific gimmick matches would take a book all by themselves. Tuxedo, evening gown, mud, country whipping have all been used to develop or blow off a feud, and sometimes it's as simple as taking the rules away. Street fights grew in mainstream popularity after Barry Windham and Arn Anderson put an incredible fight together with Doom at Starcade in 1990 for the WCW World Tag Team titles. Presented exceptionally well, both teams had cut men ready to jump in at a moment's notice. It set the bar for all over the arena violence on into the next decade. Over the next 3 years, with the help of the hardcore heroes like Cactus Jack, Max Payne, Big Van Vader, Abdullah the Butcher, and the Nasty Boys, Kevin Sullivan, and even Sting, who was not averse to cutting a rug when time came to fight, they were far more violent than their counterparts up north. It was setting a tone of what could be possible, but was also largely an occasional foray rather than a company direction. The WWF, of course, as always, not to be outdone, even though they may have come late to the dance, they didn't often get into the gimmick bag, so when they did, it meant something. The match that really grabbed attention for more discerning fans occurred at WrestleMania 10, Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon's ladder match. The premise of the ladder match had actually been popularised before in Canada. Stampede wrestling had always been an element of severe violence, in fact a little too much for some tastes. Stu Hart's over-reliance on Abdullah the Butcher and other cut-heavy bookings had nearly killed the territory in the early 70s. However, when the junior heavyweights took over the promotion, there was some wriggle room in the presentation to allow for gimmick matches when needed. The ladder match concept was outlined, indeed perfected, by Bret Hart, Bad News Allen, and the Dynamite Kid. All three had a certain style, and in Dynamite's case, a will to put their best performance possible before his own bodily well-being, making them highly anticipated affairs. The bump-heavy environment suited all three. Lighter wrestlers made for a strong box office. Bret took the idea with him to the WWF, putting the Intercontinental title on the line against Shawn Michaels for Coliseum Home Video. Michaels, whose own heroics were similar to Dynamite's philosophy of the match first, worry about the consequences later, was perhaps the perfect exponent for this kind of match. In Razor Ramon, a good friend and a very willing dance partner, they actually changed the way American fans watch wrestling. As the masked man David Shoemaker of Grantland explained, through athletic prowess and physical disregard, Michaels and Hall weren't just revolutionising the match, they were reinventing the sport. From then on, WWF was a work rate company. Match quality became part of the nuance of the main event, which it had hardly ever been before. WWF changed its approach from wrestling as a spectacle to the spectacle of wrestling, and it's what drove them through the Attitude Era, which, as I recall, often centred around three teams and a ladder. This whip around the world of gimmicks won't be the complete with the most basic gimmick match of all, and perhaps worldwide the most popular. Luchas de Apuestas, which in Spanish literally means gambling fights. While the most common variant in North American rings is now for a later stipulation, such as a title match or some storyline-related issue, the basic principles were marked out in Mexico, where even to this day, matches are highly anticipated, often bloody and violent affairs. Either mask versus mask, hair versus hair, title versus mask, or hair and many other variations, the results are taken very seriously by the local athletic commissions and are highly respected by the wrestlers, no matter where they have their bet matches. If you've been lucky enough to see WWE house shows in Mexico over the last few years, you would have seen Rey Mysterio wrestling maskless throughout his WWE run, as he had lost his mask against Kevin Nash in WCW and respected the stipulations of his bet match. Of course, WWE needed him to sell merchandise and keep continuity, so at TV tapings he would revert to his mask persona, but heavy fines are imposed on wrestlers who give up their mask and try and go back to it. You won't be seeing El Patron Alberto Del Rio going back to his mask Dos Caras Jr. gimmick in AAA, mainly because once you've been given up the mask, that's it, and it would only disrespect his father, the original Dos Caras' legacy. Bat matches can become incredibly violent. A lot is on the line, after all. In 2004, La Parca and Cybernetico had an incredibly heated and violent mask versus mask match at Triple Mania 12, in a storyline based around Cybernetico's cult-like organization, La Secta Cybernetica. The group owed a fair bit to the WWE's Ministry of Violence, but while Vince McMahon eventually joined up, the late Paco Pena, founder of AAA, was a long-term heated rival of the group. La Parca was his chosen champion, and the pair had a bloody and violent blow-off, which left Cybernetico maskless. La Parca didn't fare too well either, as his mask half ripped to shreds. Thankfully, sort of, the cape blew around what you could see of his face hid his identity. Of course, these bet matches have been combined with other stipulations. AAA have tended to favour cages, while CMLL have often had more traditional fare. During the height of the El Hijo del Santo heel turn, CMLL offered a unique match. El Dandy, Santo and Negro Casas in a three-way dance fought under elimination rules. Sadly for Dandy, his mullet was the one that got chopped. They don't have to be violent either. The match that put Eddie Guerrero on the map in North America, his AAA tag team classic alongside Love Machine and Art Bar against Octagon and El Hijo del Santo at World Worlds Collide, was a bet match. Four technically sound performers with a heated rivalry put together a titanic struggle, and Eddie and Hart had the priceless faces as their hair was cut by what they considered to be highly inferior Mexicans. And a highly illegal run-in from Rudo Blue Panther, who used the banned pile driver to even the odds against Los Gringos Locos. Some wrestlers have made a career out of collecting masks. A mask is considered more important than any title. When a wrestler loses his or her mask, their full identity is revealed and published. Often the winner will have their mask handed to them by the loser for extra effect. In hair matches, the winner usually gets the first slice with the scissors to humiliate the opponent more. Mexico is one place where bat matches have regularly become a driving force of the wrestling culture. While seen often in the US, the emphasis tends more towards the humiliation of the heel as a blow-off. In Mexico, it seems to be more even-handed, and though the humiliation is just as thoroughly exploited, it's often faces just as much as heels on the receiving end. Though we don't tend to associate mainstream Japanese wrestling with gimmick matches, as the sport's aesthetics doesn't really allow for it, All Japan Women did take the bet match to a whole new other level for women. The Kamakiri matches, death matches as they were known, are still popular feud enders today. All Japan Women didn't really have that many masked wrestlers, thus meaning that most of these matches would be hair versus hair. In a conservative environment like Japan, that meant an awful lot more. What started out as a short back and sides for Jagger Yokota back in the early 80s had developed into a full ceremonial head shaving since the emergence of wrestlers like Aja Kong and Bull Nakano. Not so bad for Aja, who favoured a mohawk anyway, but her tag partner Bison Kimura wasn't that keen on having her wavy locks shaved off, judging by her screams. Whatever era, these matches were incredibly violent because they were fought under deathmatch rules. No DQ, no count-out, which meant that in the faction-heavy world of Japanese wrestling, interference could come from all sides. The most recent of these events occurred in late 2013. Mayumi Ozaki's Oz Academy promotion is an old-school joshi company that relies on storylines that have taken years to develop through its veteran roster. Last year's big show in Yokohama featured Kamakiri match between Ozaki herself and Chiaki Nakashima. Nakashima began her career some 13 years earlier by turning on her mentor Chigusou Nagaya and joining Ozaki's Oz Academy stable in Gaia. Ozaki had been recruiting Gaia's finest young faces who had sworn allegiance to her. She turned face in 2002 and remained that largely throughout her career. Fast forward to 2011 and Mayumi Ozaki, then Oz Academy Openweight Champion, one of the most respected championships in all of Jeshi, announced she would only defend her title against Tsukiki-gun stablemates, so Nagashimi turned heel to secure her shot. It alienated her from the rest of the Suzuki-gun roster, and of course, which meant she beat Ozaki for the title, it alienated Tsukiki-gun. With nowhere to go, she fully embraced her heel side in title defences against her own stablemates, before losing the title to the regular Masakino. She took out frustration at losing the belt on her own stable, and fell into the wrath of Ozaki. A blood feud 13 years in the making blew off with a hair versus hair match. The death match rule suited Ozaki down to the ground, and her manager, Mika Nishio, and her bodyguard, police, ran interference all night for her. Nagamashi, with no friends left, was defenseless in her brawl that was highlighted by its intensity and violence. Both bloodied by the end of the bout, Nagamashi couldn't beat the odds and was shaved with great glee by Ozaki. The point of all these matches, no matter how ludicrous, was to put a full stop on a series. The special challenges were there to define a feud, not as an add-on. So how did we get where we are today? An episode of Bimpat barely goes by without some form of stipulation or hardcore device in play. The normalization of violence started long before the Attitude Era, and that is where we go to next, into the darkest recesses of pro wrestling history. A place where barbed wire was bought in wholesale quantities, and where permanent scarring wasn't just an occupational hazard, but looked forward to it with expectation. We're going to Kawasaki, the home of the true Deathmatch Kings. Now, I wrote that story 5 years ago, and the world has moved on greatly. We don't have quite so much violence anymore. Well, in certain places. Impact is still fairly violent, and we have got the rise of deathmatch companies like CZW and BJW in Japan. They're still there. We're going to go in-depth in the next episode into the serious stuff, FMW, Wing, and IWA, and going back to the hardcore era of the 1990s. Have fun, take care, and we'll see you soon. Bye! Telling Stories is part of the Treepenny Show podcast network. You can find them at Facebook, The Treepenny Show, Twitter, Treepenny Show, and the Patreon, The Treepenny Show. Please support The Treepenny Show and keep it free forever for everyone. Please also watch powerslam.tv. With your code MULLETWATCH, get a free month. Soundtrack of this particular show is written by Sheriff Lone Star and the Deputies of Heartbreak, called Salmon Salad Boogie. Follow them at Bandcamp/Sheriff Lone Star.